I ended up in this very vacation, screwed me, I signed up the second time, I don't know why. But I looked at it this way. I got a job, they put clothes on me, they fed me, they sent me to school, they gave me an airplane to fly in, they took me over to Europe, and I got to see all these countries. But they didn't tell me that somebody would be shooting at me all the time. But I survived. And I, you know, there's bad times and there's good times, but I like to look at all the fun I've had. I've had some, you know, I lost a lot of friends over there. And the worst thing in the world is to see that B-17 going down and countless perishing. Terrific force in there is so great, you're lucky you can get out of it. But anyway, I'm here.
Rocky, that's quite a story. Well, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Gaylord Ketchum. Very known as Red, because I was a redhead one time. And I'm going to tell a little different story than what these fellows here told me, because I am the new kid on the block. I went into cadets, and the Ocean Southwest and Gunnery School. I trained as a pilot in Paul Turret Gunner, and arrived overseas on April the 1st. The Middle War ended on May the 8th. Germans found out I was coming in equipped. So now I'm going to back up a little bit. As I say, I'm a new kid on the block. I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like before I went into the service. And I think a lot of you people here can relate to the story I'm going to tell you. I said, I grew up in a small town in the center of Ohio, about 10 miles to the closest town of any size. Didn't have electricity. I'd never been more than 130 miles away from home at the age of 18. And I had four sisters and a brother. When the war broke out, my father, he being a World War I veteran, sat at the dinner table one Sunday afternoon and he said, I'm going out to find a job in defense factory someplace. So he threw his suitcase in the back of the old car and he took off, left our little village in Portersville, Ohio, went up through Zanesville, Columbus, Springfield, and he wound up in Dayton. Many of you people have been in Dayton. At one time it was a very, very large industrial city. He went to work for the British Air Division of General Motors. Well, he went and applied for a job early in the morning, about 9 o'clock. And after the interview, he'd been a garage mechanic. Had his own business, lost that during the depression and so on. Anyhow, the war came along, so he was out looking for a job. He got into the British Air Division. Guess what he worked on? 50 cavalry machine guns. That was his job. On a production track. Well, he left my mother, myself, two sisters, and a younger brother at home. At the age of 15, I became the man of the house. And thanks to the training that my father gave me in teaching me things, I was able to carry on these duties. Got the driver's license at the age of 14, so we had no cars and we could get around. So standing on, he looked at our house in Dayton. At that time, he couldn't hardly even sleep in the room, but by a house. So they finally found the house, and he was moved. He was going to move on June 1st of 1944. He arranged to move the family to Dayton. Well, in the meantime, I had enlisted, going to high school. I graduated on the 24th day of May, and reported for duty on June 1st of 1944, the same day that my parents moved the family to Dayton. They took me to the little town in Lexington. I got on a train and went to Fort Thomas, Kentucky. My family came to Dayton. Talk about emotional feelings and family. See, this is one little thing that I'm sure that this happened to other people other than me. So I got into the service, reported to for duty, went to Amarillo, Texas, got my basic training. Well, while I was there, D-Day hit. Well, you know what happened? D-Day, they lost a whole lot of aircraft, lost a lot of gunners. So they washed us out of cadet program and sent us to Kingman, Arizona. Well, I completed my gunnery training on November the 11th of 1944. They gave me 14 days to get from Kingman, Arizona to Avon Park for my final phase of training for going overseas. So I got back through Dayton, and my father arranged to get off the time that I was home. And he told his foreman, he said, my son just graduated from gunnery school in Kingman, Arizona. We said, well, tomorrow, I said, you're going to be working tomorrow, so bring that boy in with you tomorrow, for showing how these machine guns are made. So I went into my father, they dropped me off at the gate, went on in onto his job. About 15 minutes later, his foreman came up, checked me through the gate, took me inside. He walked past where my father was working, and my father's name was Harry. He said, Harry, he says, shut that machine down. He said, you've been standing here for over 3 years, and you don't know what's going on down around the corner. He said, today you're going to get to see it. For the next 3 hours, my father and I and the foreman went from the punch presses to see all the assembly, down to where they fired the gun before it was packed to be sent out to where this destination would be. It was quite a thrill to get to walk through that plant and see all these things before. Well, I reported Avon Park, assigned to my crew. I was on the Don Hobie crew. Some of the boys here know Sandini here and Adosh. So knew my pilot. And we got together. So anyhow, they say I arrived in England when, well, going across, I went on the Queen Elizabeth. Sailed on the Queen Elizabeth. 52 crews for Avon Park plus 20,000 soldiers was on that boat going into Glasgow, Scotland. So we got off on it. April 1st, Easter Sunday, my 19th birthday, the one I will never forget, arriving overseas. Well, they assigned me to, there's 5 crews out of 52 were assigned to the 306 Boeing. So I say we got there late. To say the Germans quit because they found out what's coming. So anyhow, now then the war is over. What are they going to do with all these people? Well, as you know, the 305th to 306 bomb groups were chosen for occupational duty. And so that's where my job came in, out of the Casey Jones Project. But in the interim time, the time the war is over until we moved to Gibelstadt. They had a request come down from headquarters in London for a contest for a stage show. And so told us to put together about a 15-minute skit, and we're going to have a contest in London. Well, a bunch of us got together, and Harold Bandiner off Sandini's crew and I went down and applied. And both of us were chosen to go with this pack. But anyhow, lo and behold, 306 Bomber won the contest in London, in the Palladium Theater in London. So we got back to the base, and went a short time with on the intercom system. All of you guys who are in the flight stage show, report to Colonel Upham's office. So we went in and all together, we didn't know what was going on. But anyhow, we got in there and Colonel Upham talked to us. He said, well, boys, he says, your reward for winning the contest, you are to put together a 2-hour variety show, and we're going to put you on the road, traveling around to all the different camps and so on. Now, with all the boys coming in, all the battlefields, going home, and the boys are staying there, entertainment was a critical thing. So they put this show together. We were very fortunate. We had a professional magician and ventriloquist to be our anchor in the build our show around us. We call it the Ethiopian Review. So anyhow, we got the show on the road. for the next 4 months, we were relieved of all duties and we traveled all over the country. I don't know whether you remember the echoes. Just a short time back, there was an article in there on the movie and told you this story about this shooting. But on, there's about 17 of us and we traveled around. So you had a wonderful time. Well, now comes the time we're going to go to the convoy from England to Ingolstadt. Well, I drove a 4x4 weapons carrier. I carried the kitchen for the convoy, carrying K-rations. That's all we had. So when we get to on the convoy, we stopped for meals, and the last stop before we got to for lunch, I drive down along and pass out the K-rations as we went along. Well, you know, in the K-ration box is a little can of pork and beans or spam or something like that. That's cold. Well, I got mine, so I punched a hole in the can and set it on the engine head. Next stop, I had a warm meal. Well, some of the guys see me pull this can out, steam rolling off, I said, what did you do? I said, well, I got a hot meal. I said, but what, how'd you get this? Put on the engine block. But I didn't tell them to punch a hole in it. So you can imagine, about 30 minutes going down the highway, boom, smoke control drop. Bang, 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 all the time. I wasn't very popular. So anyhow, see, we got into Ingolstadt on New Year's Eve of 1945. And I was there just a very short time, and they sent me back to England to help close up another air base. In the meantime, see, I had gone to camera school because they worked up the Casey Jones project. Well, after I came back from England the second time to Ingolstadt, I was there about 14 days and he said, well, you're going to North Africa. So I wound up on Fort Lyoti as a cameraman in the Casey Jones project. I stayed there until May, finished it up in June, sealed up, got orders, closed up the program, and we came back in just as friends, border ship back home. Well, let's see, this is a little bit different story than the boys sitting here beside me. But all these duties had to be done. Well, I was only one of 16 million stories that you would like to find telling here today that you can hear. Let's see, it was a great pleasure. And all these people, every one of you here in this room, and the fellows that you're with, coming home, you came in on a little victory ship. After being only Queen Elizabeth out there for all the immigration up and down as well. Quite a wild ride. Instead of being 5 days, it was 10 coming home. But anyhow, it was a wonderful journey. I'm proud to be my share. God bless America. That's all. Thank you.
I'm sure these other men also have some additional things, but let's open it up to the audience, and as we go through, you'll probably get more of the stories. Rocky is the first one that I've ever met, even in my Army experience, who just told them they weren't going to do it. We had a couple like that, but they ended up in jail. Didn't quite work out like Rocky did, and we're glad. Barbara.
First, Karsinski, were you with the same family the whole time that you were an evadee?
I can't hear what you're saying.
Were you with the same family the whole time you were underground?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, gentlemen?
Well, after being shot down, I walked along the highway for about a week, and then I finally got in touch with the underground, and they assigned me to three fellows from the underground. And then after about a month or so, they transferred me to a family and had a small child actually they contacted me in a way when I'm walking down on the road in France. I come to the Seine River, and the only way to get across would be the ferry boat. Well, the Germans owned the ferry boat, so that took care of that. So I stopped a Frenchman and inquired about continuing closer to our lines, because we were shot down. It was 11 days after D-Day. So I was kind of trying to walk back to our lines. And he introduced me to the fellows that were rowing the boat. And we got across the river, and they pointed out a cafe. And they, well, that's where I went. So I stayed there for about 3 hours, and I got tired of waiting. So I figured I had to cross the river. So I got to a certain point, and the right near the ferry boat, and a couple of P-38s decided to try to bomb the ferry boat. They missed again. But anyway, I found another abandoned building that I was in, and a Frenchman come in, and he's asking me in French, "What are you doing here?" And I says, "Oui." Meaning everything was weed. So anyway, he said, "It's too dangerous to stay here. Follow me." So we followed him for about a half a mile. He said, "Now you wait here." And I was a little suspicious because he was a well-dressed, blonde, blue-eyed Frenchman. I figured, "Oh, this guy's a Nazi," you know. As it turned out, he came back with a woman with a basket of food. But I told him, "I haven't eaten in a week." And so they fed me. I couldn't hardly eat anything, but the stomach had shrunk. So they took me to another home, and I met several people. And just the went like from family to family. And I'm trying to think again. And anyway, I ended up with this fellow that came in, as well dressed, Charles. He was in contact with the underground. So he would set it up, he would set up, I was assigned to three fellows that would be with me all the time for the next month or so. And I'm kind of lost. And anyway, I was with them for a while, and then Charles came and took me and put me with his family, which was, he figured it was a lot safer. And I stayed there until the Canadian tank outfit liberated the village. And then back to London. Actually, there was a lot of people don't realize that the Allies had a special team that went around picking up all us stragglers. In fact, they told me, "Don't go to Paris because it's overcrowded. And food is tough to forget. And stay where you're at in a farm, which is much better." Although food was very difficult. Well, anyway, after this team found me, because all of the underground people had kept track of all the GIs that were shot down or were being hidden. So anyway, the word got around, and I had a major come with a jeep and pick me up. Took me, there were several stops we had to make because we were picking up people who were going back to our line. But this was 3 months after the invasion. So anyway, we got back on the C-47 and flew me back to London. And then after interrogation, went back to the base to try to find my clothes. They were already boxed and shipped to London. I went back to London. Fortunately, I found my clothes at the warehouse that they sent me to. At least I had a uniform. After that, they got on a boat, went back home, and believe me, pulling into New York Harbor was really something. It was the first time in a year and a half that I got overseas that I seen all these lights, all these car lights. Over in Europe, they didn't have that. All the lights were dim, and as you come by, you stand on the bridge.
Unforgettable. Any other questions? It's a wonder that he wasn't picked up, you know, walking down that road. As he told me about that, it made me remember we had a German POW camp in Abilene during the war, and a bunch of those Germans escaped. But they were all captured, and they were just sort of stunned by that. They couldn't figure out why. Well, when they captured them, they were had their arms linked together. They were walking down the road, marching, singing German folk songs in West Texas. Question? Yes.
Bob, when you were you physically okay from when you parachuted down? Were you hurt at all when you landed?
When you parachuted, were you hurt or were you physically okay when you hit the ground?
Well, we bailed out our number of trains and was on fire. The pilot started talking to the navigator and said, well, which was closer to go back to England or our lines? He said, if either way it'd be about the same distance. So that's when the pilot said, crew bailout. So one of the problems I had with being a tail gunner, I had the chest chute. I couldn't wear the chest chute while I was flying. Well, I always kept it in back. In back of me, it had like a little bench that you kind of sit on and you reach around for the gun. Well, that's pulling out of the formation. The chute slipped all the way back to the rear landing wheel. So in the meantime, I'm taking off the oxygen mask, getting my parachute, getting back to the escape hatch, and I had a difficulty with the cable. Well, I finally pulled the door, pulled the cable and the door fell off. And I reached over and I had a pair of shoes. They tell you to carry a pair of shoes, civilian shoes. So if you land, you have a pair of shoes. And anyway, I bailed out. I don't remember opening the chute because I was probably without oxygen for at least a minute or so. And I was floating down and done a screwy thing. A B-51 fighter come by, so I couldn't help them. You know? And after that, he went down. So after us falling down, therefore, a lot of it all gone. I didn't see how fast I was falling. But when I got through the clouds, I'm coming down very fast. So I'm coming right to a hedgerow. I picked up my feet to miss the hedgerow, and I landed flat on my back. Fortunately, everything was okay, and I stayed there till it got dark, about 11 o'clock at night. I do get shot down. Shot down was about 11 in the morning. I went to the farmhouse and knocked on the door, and they let me in. And so fortunately, I had my escape kit, which we carry. They had money, maps, a chocolate, and I poured it out to them in the freeze kit. Can you hide me? You know, and Buckle Bush and 20 Germans. So they did give me some clothes. I asked for clothes, and I found out I had a map, so I knew exactly where I was. And about 12 o'clock, he helped some amigos, you know, and I started walking. And I ended up in a German barracks area. And as I'm walking down the sidewalk, I heard this clank of boots. So I ducked in the doorway, and there were two German guards. Anyway, I kind of backtracked and went into what I thought was a safe place in the yard. So we're looking around, and complete dark. Well, you can see pretty good in the completely dark. So anyway, I decided to go to this. One of them was like a garage, and there was a German car in there, one of those Jeeps. So I figured, oh, this isn't a good place to stay. I heard they're coming back, the car's coming back, so I sat in a corner, put my head in my knees. I didn't dare move. Well, after they left, I noticed that the building that was kind of bombed out. Well, right across the building, I found it later, was the German barracks. And I managed to climb up to the second floor, and that's where I stayed that night. So the next day, I woke up, I heard voices. I looked out through a hole in the wall, and there were two German soldiers there with a rifle. And the barracks was right there. So, I thought, well, it's not safe to walk, because I could see the civilians walking down the street. I stayed there another day, so early next morning, I left and kept walking down, and kept walking and walking. And I stopped by, anyway, it was very convenient. They had a cafe and they had sciences, beer and soda. So I already had the French francs. I went and ordered a beer, and it was very good. Anyway, one of the problems I had was I've always needed a haircut. And I'm walking down the street. Oh, by the way, I have to go back to the French couple that gave me the clothes. They asked if you want a beret, and I said, no, I should have taken it. But anyway, I starting to attract attention, my hair flying all over the place, and old clothes. And I was stopped by a German officer that was using a bicycle. He was checking the French. They were digging trenches alongside the road. One of the problems, I have to go back again, is the clothes they gave me, the shoes were a size too small. And that was the big problem. I was limping and bleeding. And anyway, the German called me over and he asked me for papers in French. I could understand that much. And I said, no, all I did was mention the name of the next village, which was Baalbek, because I can tell that by the map. So after a while, he looked three times, he looked down at my shoes. If I had my regular shoes, I'd be a dead duck. But I had the old beat up shoes. In fact, I offered the Frenchman all the money I had, all the French francs, for the other shoe. He wouldn't give them to me. So anyway, I was on my way.
Now, for Rocky, if I understand, you were there in late 42, right? Can you tell us what it was like? That was a pretty rough period of the war for the...
No, that was a good part. I was there much earlier than that. I went home in 44.
I'm talking 42 when you were...
Oh, 42, yeah. I got there in October, last part of October. I don't know whether you people know it or not, but actually, the 306 is part of the Four Horsemen. There were four bomb groups that went in, and we were the third one that went in that early. When I got to the air base, they were shut down. The morale was absolutely terrible. The losses were terrible. We had no fighter escort except for the Spitz, and they could only fly into France, and then they would have to turn around, and you look out, the Luftwaffe was sitting there waiting for you 50 miles in the head. Yeah, it was bad, pretty bad. And when I got there, they were shut down. Guys were reporting to the hospital sick, so they didn't have to fly. Casualties were way high. We had very few planes. We didn't put up what the later fellows did. We didn't have them. And of course, no fighter escort. It was pretty bad. The first mission, well, after we got back flying again, it was formation. Tighten up that formation. Take your antenna and put it up in the wheel well of the guy over top of you. That's what they wanted. Put your wing and tuck it in behind the other, your leader's wing, and get the formation tighter together. The firepower in this squadron was pretty good. With all those 50 calibers on there, when they added the chin turret, that was a big deal. When I first got there, we didn't have the chin turret. And you had the navigator, and the bomber was actually a gunner also, you know. And yeah, pretty bad. And you go out at 18 years old and you think you're indefensible, nobody's going to shoot you down. That's the way I felt. And a lot of guys did. They're not going to get me. And yet, when you got in and you got over there, the bad part was when the Spitz left us, you had the Luftwaffe, and if you had a mission that was 6 hours long, six and a half or something, you flow into the target and the Luftwaffe was here, 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 waiting for you. When you came out, they were there, here, 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 waiting for you to come back out. So you had combat from the time you hit the French coast until you got back to the French coast. And there were times that some of the gunners ran out of ammunition, what we carried, because that's all they were doing. You know, they're shooting at me and I'm shooting at them. And it was hectic, there's no doubt about it. And as engineer, my job was to... I was taught, and a lot of guys I don't think was done this, but I had a pilot in the States. And he said to me one day, he says, you're third man in the cockpit, you've got to learn to fly this airplane. I says, well, in my contract, it doesn't say that. And he says, well, let's look at it this way.
Like that, we're a volunteer.
If I get killed, the co-pilot's going to need somebody in that seat. And if he gets killed, I'm going to need somebody in that seat. So he says, you're going to learn how to fly. Which, to this day, I'm very faithful of that. I don't know what his name was because it was in the States. And I had about 70 hours. I have landed a B-17, I've taken it off. And God Willie, nothing ever happened like that. I've had a bombardier get killed, not me. But everybody else, when I had a solid crew, find me, when I first went there, I was an engineer. They were so short on gunners, I flew a waste position for 5 years, I flew in the waste. And then I went back and got a full crew, which was great. I was on Peck's Bad Boy, which is a line out of the Bible, says that he will return. And God help that I return. And stupidly enough, along the way, I volunteered for the second tour. I don't know why. And I got through. I never got wounded. I've had a couple on the crew get wounded, and that was part of my job to take care of. Patch holes, put cables together or whatever, go in there and crank the bomb bay doors open. And you talk about stupid. After I got home, I got thinking about it. And I, like, ball turret, tail gunner, and me, we did not wear a parachute because you couldn't get in. Ball turret is that. This guy's an idiot for getting in. Well, that's the way it was. You know, I had a chest shoot. I had a British chest shoot that didn't take up much room, so I could keep it up by the turret on the floor. And then I got worried about it, and I had a piece of armor plate put under it, so I wouldn't have any holes in it if I had to bail out. But it's very treacherous, and those three positions are very bad. That gentleman there in that tail compartment, how anybody could sit there. You either kneel or you had to sit like this in a little tiny seat for 6, 7, 8 hours, right? And he had to lead his chute out by the tail wheel in the back of him. And then he had to crawl out around that tail wheel to get to the door. I had a chute, and I either went down between the pilot or co-pilot, or he would open up the bomb bay doors if the bombs were gone and just drop out the bomb bay. So, yes, it was hectic until when we had P-38s first, and then when the P-51 came along, God bless their souls, our little friends, they could take us all the way in. And I flew on a first mission that the book that Russ Strong wrote of First Over Germany. We went out on a mission, and the 306 was on it. And when we got over the continent, the weather got bad, and we were headed for Germany, but they finally recalled it. The lead pilot claimed that his radio didn't work, and he never received the order to return. And the 306 went in, bombed German territory for the first time. I don't know whether you people know this or not, but that's what our title is, First Over Germany. Okay? I finished 38 missions. I was called in 1944. One of the main pilots went back to the States, and he asked for me as engineer, and I was assigned to B-29s to go to Japan. I flew back home in a C-54 with four guys from Connecticut with me, and I had the fattest pilot I ever saw in my life. He could not get between that wheel and that seat. And we finally had to end up to take the bolts out of the back and move it back a point so he could get in there, right? We had a bunch of guys got aboard, and we headed for home. And this is a C-54, not a B-17. And a crap game started. I never gambled in my life. And I got in that crap game, and when we got to Newfoundland, I had won $3,000. I don't know how God's name I ever won it. I built, my father was a carpenter, and I built my first house with that money. I got started when I got, this is a long ways from what he had. No, I did 38 missions, and I've done Berlin. The worst ones were Schweinfurt. That was the worst, I think the worst. The first one I had was Williamshaven, and I was a waste gunner. That was the first mission I did as a waste gunner. And I went on a crew that had flew before me. And the other waste gunner on the other side was across from me and back of me. We got to Williamshaven, and I didn't know this until later on, but this kid over here, I don't even know his name. They didn't do things where they listed your name and things like that in the beginning. You just got in the airplane and flew. I didn't know, but he had a problem, and he had been up to the hospital or something. And anyway, we got over at Williamshaven, and the plaque started. And we got over, absolutely over the target. And I was busy. I mean, we didn't have airplanes to shoot at, but you still got things to do. And I turned around and he wasn't there. I called the pilot and I says, you know, the left gunner, waste gunner is missing. He said, what the hell you mean he's missing? I says, he isn't here, but his parachute is sitting on the floor. I look over and the door is loose and he bailed out. He went berserk and bailed out over the target. And he was never listed. I don't see how he could have been listed as a prisoner of war. And I don't know what went wrong, but he bailed out. And it's a horrible thing to turn around and see somebody that jumped out of an airplane without a parachute. So anyway, yeah, things were tough in the beginning, believe me.
That's right. Other questions? Let's go over here first.
Why is morale bad in 42, and why did it get bad?
Who do you want to direct this to?
Rocky.
Okay, Rocky, why was morale bad in 42, and why did it get better?
Well, when we first got there, I wasn't the first one there, but I was there in October. And like I say, they were shut down. The casualties, I know one day, 367 sent up 5 airplanes, 2 came back. We lost 3. Now, I don't know about the other 3 squadrons, but just put that together. You've got 10 men on a crew, figure it out. We were short on airplanes. They had just gotten into manufacturing really on a production basis and trying to get them over to us. We were short on crews. You were lucky when you went to school and you spent a week or 2 weeks, you were really lucky. They were shoving everybody through trying to get crews together. And when I went in, well, basic training don't count, that's idiotic. I think it was Amarillo, Texas. And all that was there was a little hangar that said Brandon Airway on it. And the Army Air Corps had taken it over and they were going to build it. But we didn't have any barracks to go in. Everything was crude. Every place I went, there was nothing ready. We were just starting. And I ended up, I went to gunnery school in Las Vegas. I was there only for a week. And they put me in mechanic school. And I was only there a week and a half. And you graduate, you know. You don't learn much in a week and a half. And I finally ended up at Boeing Aircraft and Engineering School, because that's what I was assigned for. And I went to the civilian day. The civilian from the aircraft factory taught the engineering. And I learned how to practically take that airplane apart and put it back together again. That's what would be my job in the air. But when we got there, like I say, the morale was so bad. They were losing so many men. You had no escort, and chances are, like they say, if you did 5 missions, you'd be a real lucky person. And everybody was getting sick. Bill Houlihan can tell you this because he worked in the hospital. And they were lined up to where they were. It was like a revolt that we were getting killed, and nobody seemed to be doing anything about it. And it just got bad, and they just wouldn't fly. They refused to fly. They shut the bottom group down, pulled out the commander, and assigned a new commander to us, and that's just before I got there, and trying to reorganize the operation, or the 306, and put it back in so it was, you know, combatable. And what I did when I first got there was train, like I said, and they finally figured out, well, we'll try it again, you know. Well, we had rough times, but things a little long, then we started getting more planes, and then we got the chin turret on, which helped a lot, and better airplanes. They were a little bit better, they were making improvements in them, and things gradually got better. But when the fighter planes came along, that P-51 was a godsend when they put those belly tanks on it, and they could run us all the way in, all the way into Berlin and back. And I know at one time we got hit pretty bad and lost an engine, and I was flying with Bill Rutherford. And he says, Rocky, we got to make a decision. I said, what? He says, do you think we can make it back to England? So between the co-pilot and I and the navigator, we figured out, we were figuring out how many gallons an hour, which is 50 gallons an hour per engine, and 30 gallons of oil per engine per hour, and figure out if we had enough gas. We were inside Germany to get back to the coast. And up in front of us is Switzerland. Now, we had a choice. We could go to Switzerland and be interned for the rest of the war, or we could take a shot and go back. So we figured it all out, and we had a tank that had hit, and we lost fuel, and we were close, but the navigator, the co-pilot, and I agreed that we had a shot at it. So we took a vote. Actually, all the crew voted, and they said England. So we swung out. Once you drop out of that formation, you're a dead duck if you don't watch it, because those German fighters are looking for you. And we had to drop out, turn around, and head back ahead of time, and tried to stay at altitude, and then we had trouble with another engine that wasn't running right. Had a feather to prop to kind of soothe it along. And we got all the way out to almost into the Netherlands, and a P-51 picked us up. Went around like this, wobbled like this, and you got a friend, and God bless him. And he rode us out, got us out to the coast, and we made it back to England and got back to Thurloy. So those are the kind, some guys did that and they went down in the channel. But the P-51s, once we got them, they were there when we needed them, you know? So yeah, it was tough, and it got easier, but I'm not saying for the fellas that came later, it wasn't any easier, because they didn't have the fighter planes, but they had flak, and that's just as bad. I mean, you know, you could sit there and watch it like this, and I pray to God I don't hit the next one, you know? And well, like I say, the fellas that came in later, they didn't have any joyride injury. So I hope, does that answer your question?
Now, when did Dr. Schuller start that number of missions to go home?
Well, Dr. Schuller is the one that decided that 25 missions was about all one man could stand. You're either becoming a drunk or an idiot, you know? And, well, you know, 17-year-old kids, 18, what, the pilots are older, 21, or maybe 20, someone. But you had this attitude that we came over here and we're going to do a job if we can. And but Dr. Schuller was the one that was handling the casualties. And these guys that were refusing to fly, and they weren't refusing really just to be arrogant, but it was getting to them. It gets to you after a while. Doing it, climbing up in that thing every day gets to be a hazard. And he put in that the crew should do 25 missions, and they finally accepted it. And that was, well, that was in what, I think it was 43, early part of 43 when they finally decided you could do 25.
Okay, I have a question for Jack. I would like you to tell us your most exciting time and memory flying with your crew.
Well, most exciting time of my crew. Well, everyone in my crew was my pilot. It was my second mission, and his first, just second. And it was to Ruling on September 12, 1944. And I think our group lost 10 planes that day. Wow. And I had another exciting time when we bailed out.
Tell us about that.
Well, we were coming back. We'd already been to the target, crossed the channel, and there was a fire that started in the nose of the plane. And the engineer, well, Bombay door, the handle was off. He couldn't open it, and he kicked it down. And when he kicked it down, there was a big pile of black smoke that came into the fuselage. And nobody had to tell you to go then. We left. And we had one man that lost his life that time, and two that were burning in flying.
Yes, it was. We had an article in Echoes about it. We're running out of time here, and I want to make sure that we allow a few people who have not asked questions, if you have some, of our panel, I'd like to give you a chance to ask. All these have been great questions that's prompted great answers. Anyone else? Okay, yes.
Generally, what was the... Everybody complains about the weather, and I guess flying can be affected by the weather. How often would you actually would you fly? Were there ever periods of time where everybody was grounded for a while, or would you take off into the icky weather because you had to?
Well, I think that we have a number of pilots who could answer that, but of course there are times when you can't take off. And a lot of times they flew when the weather was too bad, but they flew anyway, and we had a lot of mid-air collisions. Walt was telling us a story about taking off, and he couldn't even see the ends of his wings. That was a common thing. And so jolly old England has this image of sort of a foggy town in London town and all of that. It's very difficult to fly an aircraft in World War II. A lot easier, I think, Marty Wegner would be able to take care of that. He flies into London all the time, and he takes off in that fog. He has no trouble with it. He's got instruments that Walt and the rest of the pilots didn't have. Anyone have any comments about that before we go on to the next question?
Well, they don't burn coal over there no more like they used to.
Yeah.
The fog has gone away now.
Yes, question here.
I was just curious if this might be directed to Mr. Ketchum, but being part of the occupational forces, I'm curious if you had any interesting stories you could share with the local townspeople when you were in Germany in 46 as part of the occupational forces. And my dad used to tell me some interesting, actually good humored stories when he was there. In 46, I'm wondering if you have any you can share.
Yes, in 46 when I left there, as I recall, British people were very receptive of us right up to the very, very end to when we all left the country. And I can't really recall any incidents, but we were still welcome.
We've got time for a couple more questions. Hay preguntas? We'll do it all in Spanish from this point on. Yes,
I'm just going to ask the obvious question of Jack is, what was it like sitting in that ball turret for 4, 5, 6 hours or whatever it was? And I'll ask Rocky's question that he asked the other day.
You got to get your head put on straight before you get in. And you got to make up your mind you're going to be in it, and that's your position. You get used to it. I flew seven missions, my last seven because our crew was split up. And I flew other positions on 17s, and I have to say I'd take the ball there again because I got used to it. I can sit and tell you how you're locked into it. You gotta have a good waist guard. I have one named Colin Sheehan from South Carolina, and he kept my parachute in the same place all the time. So when I, if I came up, I knew where it was. But you need to help.
I told you he's an idiot. can you imagine a guy, they swung the turret down like this, the waist gunner, you had a good buddy in that waist. They would open up that door, you climbed in, he's got his two chins in his mouth. You can't see a thing, they're only looking down. The guy shuts the lid down, turns the key, he can't get out. Once that key is turned, he cannot get out of there. If both of those waist gunners got killed, he's in a bad place. And one thing that the crews did was to keep talking to each other. That's the only way you knew everybody was okay. That's why it's like a family in that airplane. Every guy looked after everybody else. And if something, you call in and some guy didn't answer, there was a chance that he got sick and he threw up in his oxygen mask and it froze and he would die from lack of oxygen. It was simple as that. And this guy sitting down there, if his radio got disconnected, he did not know what the hell was going on. And I sat in a turret one time, and I got down there, and I went around like this, and I couldn't see that. Holy God, I fell out of the airplane. There ain't nobody above me. You're out in the middle of the world all by yourself down there, believe me. That's why I still think he's an idiot.
I think that we owe a great deal to Jack here, and so I would propose that as an association, we purchase and have manufactured an easy chair for his living room that's shaped like a ball turret. Question. And there's some other questions I think she's wanting to know about. If you had to take a pit stop, did the pilot just land somewhere for you?
You opened up the Bombay door. Well, they had a relief tube. Yeah, don't ask about if you could get to it.
Yeah, did that work good?
No.
I think someone mentioned that they carried some rations and things with them.
Frozen. One question for Jack. Jack, did you ever land in the ball turret?
No, you can't.
No, you can't.
My crew members did.
No, I don't believe anybody wants to do that.
We had one come down on the air base that the ball turret man couldn't get out of, and they had a land with him there, and he never survived. That's why I say that. I think to me that's the most dangerous place on the airplane.
Well, our time is up, but let's give a great thanks to our guests. Next year we'll have some more of these.